messy, your neighbors see you do it, and what you thought was worth digging for is never as valuable as you thought it was. Even if you could go back to where you were, any relationship you might have with an ex will be colored by all of the issues that led up to the breakup. In other words, you know what the end result of those issues has been. It will always be the 800-pound gorilla in the room in any future relationship. As I elaborated in the desire dynamic, healthy relationships are founded on genuine mutual desire, not a list of negotiated terms and obligations. And this is, by definition, exactly what any post-breakup relationship necessitates. You or she may promise to never do something again. You may promise to rebuild the trust. You may promise to be someone else. But you cannot promise to accept that the issues leading up to the breakup don't have the potential to dissolve it again. The doubt is there. You may be married for 30 years, but there will always be that one time when you two broke up, or she fucked that other guy, and everything you think you've built with her over the years will always be compromised by that doubt of her desire. You will never escape her impression that you were so optionless you had to beg her back to rekindle her intimacy with you. The extraordinary effort you would need to get her back is far better spent on a new prospective woman with whom you have no history. Iron Rule Number 8. Iron Rule of Tomasi Number 8. Always let a woman figure out why she won't fuck you. Never do it for her. Rolo, I'm newly game aware, red pill guy, and I've been meeting girls with more and more success since my conversion, but I can't help the feeling that the really hot girls I want to get with are so out of my league. Any suggestions? An integral part of maintaining the feminine imperative as the societal imperative involves keeping women as the primary sexual selectors. As I've detailed in many prior comments and posts, this means that a woman's sexual strategy necessitates that she be in as optimized a condition as her capacity, attractiveness, allows for her to choose from the best males available to satisfy that strategy. This is really the definition of hypergamy. And on an individual level, I believe only the most plugged in of men don't realize this to some degree of consciousness. However, what I think escapes a lot of men is the complex nature of hypergamy on a social scale. For hypergamy to sustain its dominant position as the default sexual strategy for our society, it's necessary for the feminine imperative to maintain existing, foster new, and normalize complex social conventions that serve it. The scope of these conventions range from the individualized psychological conditioning early in life to the grand scale of social engineering, e.g., feminism, religion, government, etc. One of these social conventions that operates in the spectrum of the personal to the societal is the idea of leagues. The fundamental idea that social matching theory details is that all things being equal, an individual will tend to be attracted to and are more likely to pair off with another individual who is of the same or like degree of physical attractiveness as themselves. In a vacuum, this is the germ of the idea behind the leagues. The social convention of leagues mentality is where all things are not equal and used to support the feminine imperative, while conveniently still supporting the principle of social matching theory. The latent function of leagues is to encourage men to filter themselves out for women's intimate approval. As social conditions progress and become more complex, so do men's ability to mimic the personal attributes of providership and security. In other words, lesser men become intelligent enough to circumvent women's existing sexual filters and thus thwart their sexual strategy. These ever-increasing complexities made it hard to identify optimally suitable men from the pretenders, and women, being the primary sexual selector, needed various social constructs to sort the wheat from the chaff. With each subsequent generation, They couldn't be expected to do all of this detective work on their own, so the feminine imperative enlisted the aid of the men themselves and created self-perpetuated, self-internalized social doctrines for men to comply with in order to exist in a feminine-defined society. The concept of leagues is just one of these doctrines. Your self-doubt about your worthiness of a woman's intimacy stems from a preconditioned idea that you are out of her league. The Booster Club optimist idea that if you think you can't, you're right, is true. And boundless enthusiasm may overcome some obstacles, but to address the source of the disease, it's more important to ask yourself why you've been taught to think you can't. A lot of approach anxiety comes from your own self-impression. Am I smooth, hot, affluent, funny, confident, interesting, decisive, well-dressed enough to earn an HB9's attention? How about an HB6? Our great danger is not that we aim too high and fail, but that we aim too low and succeed. I'm not debating the legitimacy of the evaluative standards of the sexual marketplace. It's a harsh, often cruel reality. What I'm really trying to do is open your eyes as to why you believe you are only meritorious of an HB7. Looks count for a lot, as does game, affluence, personality, talent, etc. But is your self-estimation accurate? Or are you a voluntary participant in your own self-devaluation in the SMP, courtesy of the league's mentality the feminine imperative would have you believe? The economy of the league. As I stated above, the purpose of fomenting a stratified league mentality in men serves to autonomously filter the lesser from the greater men for women to choose from. However, it also functions to increase the valuation of the feminine as a commodity. Like any great economic entity, the feminine imperative lives and dies by its ability to inflate its value in the marketplace. Essentially, the feminine imperative is a marketeer. One of the sad ironies of this and the last century is that the feminine imperative has attempted to base women's SMP valuation on a collective importance to the detriment of the individual woman's SMV. For men, this is inverted. A man's sexual valuation is primarily individualized, while men as a collective gender are devaluated in the SMP. What I mean by this is that, as a collective entity, women's sexuality cannot afford to be perceived as anything less than the more valued prize. If all vaginas are considered the gold standard, then men's sexual default value will always be lower. By this definition, men, on whole, are out of women's league. For further consideration, let's assume that average men, most being varying degrees of beta, are blessed with the miraculous gift of an average woman's sexual attentions. The power dynamic is already pre-established to defer to a feminine frame. So it's no small wonder that men would be prone to one-itis even with an objectively average woman. This is the intent of the league schema: to unobjectively predispose men to commitment with women who under objective condition couldn't enjoy the same selectivity. It's been postulated that for a healthy relationship to exist, the man must be recognized by the woman to be 1 to 2 points above her own SMV. This is a pretty tall order, considering the feminine imperative's emphasis on women's sexuality being the more valued as default. This is nothing to say of contemporary women's overinflated self-evaluations due to the rise of social media. Gaming the league. All of the above isn't to say that there isn't a kernel of truth to the notion of leagues. It's just not the truth men have been led to believe. For as much as the feminine imperative would have men subscribe to leagues, it equally seeks to exempt women from the same league hierarchy by evaluating women as a whole. Needless to say, men have their own rating systems, most popularly the ubiquitously physical HB Hot babe, 1 to 10 scale. I should add that it's a foregone conclusion that any rating system men would establish for women in the feminine reality would necessarily need to be ridiculed, shamed, and demonized. But you knew that already. Irrational self-confidence is a good start to circumventing and unlearning the concept of leagues. Unlearning this conditioning being the operative goal. The game-aware man can actually use the concept of leagues to his advantage with enough guile. When you approach a woman without regard to a league mentality, or even a zen-like obliviousness to it, aka Corey Worthington, the Alpha Buddha, you send the message that there's more to you than a feminine reality can control. It's exactly this disregard for the influence of the feminine imperative that makes the alpha attractive. He's unaware of, or indifferent to, the rules his conditioning should have taught him earlier. Just in the attempt of gaining a woman obviously out of your league, you flip the feminine script by planting a seed of doubt and prompting imagination about your perceived value. Doubt is a very powerful tool. In fact, the very concept of leagues is founded upon men's doubt. Turn that tool to your advantage by disregarding women's social convention of leagues. Iron Rule 9. Iron Rule of Tomasi number 9. Never seriously self-deprecate with a woman you intend to be intimate with. Apologizing for a lack of game isn't game. One disservice I think most men tend to overlook is an attitude of self-depreciation that they'll resort to as a means of engendering interest in a potential woman by attempting to play to her sympathies. Case in point. Printed with permission. Subject: My apologies for being a complete douche. Body: I actually wanted to call and talk to you tonight, but I just moved into my new place today and lost track of time, and now it's after midnight. Anyways, I was a complete tool the last time we talked. I thought about what you said to me, and I really have been lame lately. I think back to our first couple of dates, and I realize what a complete and boring reject I was. Those weren't so much dates as me trying way too hard to impress you as someone that was mature. Bad word choice. But I don't know what I was doing, and not myself. Anyways, I now realize I need to get this pole out of my ass and start having fun again in my life, which is why I have been in a drunken stupor for the last 2 weekends. I hope we can start hanging out again, because I do enjoy your company. But I promise if we do, I will drink, relax, and not be such a wallflower. I also promise no more gay-ass text messages. I hate when people do that to me, so I can only imagine how retarded I look when I do it. Alan. This was an actual email passed on to me from a young woman I counseled after she blew this guy off over the course of 3 dates, and is one of many emails and IM texts I've gone over time and time again with women. This is a textbook example of how men will resort to self-depreciation tactics in order to provoke an "it's okay, I understand" sympathy response from a woman with the expectation that she'll take pity on him for being a flawed man and give him a second chance, or third, or fourth chance, or any chance at all. This is a direct manifestation of men being socially conditioned to recognize and acknowledge their weaknesses, and in confessing them, they will become strengths, and ergo, attractions, since they mistakenly believe that doing so will make them not like other guys, and therefore unique. You see, I'm really a sensitive, introspective guy willing to cop to his own character flaws. Please love me. Iron Rule of Tomasi number 9. Never self-deprecate under any circumstance. This is a kiss of death that you self-initiate and is the antithesis of the prize mentality. Once you've accepted yourself and presented yourself as a complete douche, there's no going back to confidence with a woman. Never appeal to a woman's sympathies. Her sympathies are given by her own volition, never when they are begged for. Women despise the obligation of sympathy. Nothing kills arousal like pity. Even if you don't seriously consider yourself pathetic, it never serves your best interest to paint yourself as pathetic. Self-depreciation is a misguided tool for the AFC, and not something that would even occur to an alpha. People seem to get confused about how self-deprecation really functions. I'm not suggesting that a man take himself so seriously that he can't laugh at himself. In fact, a brilliant tactic is to present a prevailing, ambient sense of seriousness, then admit to and laugh at whatever goof it was that removes you from it. Nothing endears a man more to a woman than to think only she can break through your shell and get you to find humor in yourself. However, true self-deprecation, as illustrated in Allen's lowercase a noted email, is self-initiated. It's not the ha-ha, look, I slipped on a banana peel sense of deprecation. It's the I'm a complete douche, but really I'm worth the effort apologetic sense of deprecation. There is a marked difference between being pathetic and being able to laugh at yourself in good faith. I'm not advocating that guys never own up to mistakes or wrongs they do. You should sensibly apologize in given situations depending on the conditions and do so appropriately. However, self-depreciation is another mental schema entirely. Humility is a virtue up to a point, but it's simply not a virtue that a woman you're interested in will ever appreciate in the manner you think they will, and in fact often conveys the opposite intent. Virtuous humility is no substitute for self-confidence. If you are already involved with a woman, she may develop a socially mandated sense of appreciation. But again, this is only up to the threshold of you trading her estimation of your confidence for your ability to address fault on your part. When a woman delivers a shit test based on this, and a guy submits through self-depreciation, it's damage done that's not easily undone. Admitting fault is not a strength that inspires women. It's still about the fault. It may be the honorable, necessary, truthful thing to do, but don't believe for a moment women will value you more in the confession of fault. That said, true self-depreciation is pervasive. Contemporary men have become so steeped in deprecation and male ridicule by popular media that it seems a normative way of attracting women. The message is, women love men who laugh at men. Thus, you have to be hyper aware of it and unlearn it. You have to catch yourself in mid-sentence, so to speak. Women operate in the sub-communications, and when you overtly admit to a lack of confidence in yourself or your collective gender, you may as well just LJBF yourself. That's a strong impression you won't recover from easily, if ever. Women want a competent, confident, decisive man from the outset, not one whose self-image is that of a complete douche or even a partial douche. The stereotype of the quirky but lovable guy who bumbles his way into a woman's heart may work for romantic comedies, but not in the real world. I should also add that when you become hyper aware of this, you can also turn it to your own advantage when dealing with a competitor or you're sarging a girl with a self-depreciative boyfriend or suitor. It's all too easy to reinforce her estimation of a guy like this by covertly confirming it for her, while at the same time playing up your own confidence and value. All of this is not to say that it's wrong to recognize your own weaknesses and understanding when you're in the wrong. It's simply how you go about addressing it that's the point. There are plenty of ways to assume the responsibilities of fault that aren't self-depreciating. The easiest way is to always adopt the attitude that you're getting better all the time. This mentality fosters confidence and projects ambition, whereas self-depreciation shoves your nose in the dog shit and says, please love me anyway.
Chapter 10, Part 1.
Mythology. The myth of the lonely old man. Is loneliness a disease that necessitates a cure? If men could be made to believe so, think of the potential profit to be made from and the potential for manipulation of men. The real test for a man is how he lives with himself alone. Precious few men ever truly allow themselves to be alone and learn real, singular independence and self-reliance. The vast majority of guys, see betas, particularly in Western culture, tend to transition from mother to wife with little or no intermission between. For the most part, they subscribe to the feminine imperative, becoming serial monogamous, going from LTR to LTR until they settle without ever having learned and matured into how to interact as an adult. The fear of loneliness is entirely too exaggerated in modern Western romanticism. The popularized fear mythology of becoming the lonely old man who never loved is the new old maid myth made popular in an era when a woman's worth was dependent upon her marital status and, at least now, equally as false a premise. But in our brave new Generation AFC, men who've become women are repackaged and shamed into believing this horseshit as part and parcel of feminized gender role reversal. Thus, we get speed dating and eHarmony and a host of other conveniences to pacify the insecurities that this reversal instills. I'm going to suggest that most AFCs, most feminized conditioned males, like and embrace the lonely old man myth because it is a buffer against potential rejection. Does that sound like a stretch? It shouldn't. When used from a feminized perspective, this myth is most certainly a shaming social convention with the latent function of getting men to commit to a feminine frame. You better change yourself soon, or your soulmate might pass you by, and you'll be lonely and destitute in your old age. That's the feminized use of the myth. However, the internalized AFC use of the myth is a buffer. This then becomes his rationale for settling for a substandard LTR or marriage. Better to marry a shrew than suffer loneliness. It's really a triple whammy. There's the feminine reinforced fear of solitude. Then, the self-reinforced expectation of maturity or doing the right thing. And finally, the use of it as a convenient retreat from rejection or potential rejection. And this is what I'm getting at when I refer to it as a buffer. Case example. I have a friend who is trapped in a passionless marriage with a woman who set the frame from day one. He'd like to come off as dominant with his male friends, but it's clear to most of our friends that his wife owns the frame of the marriage. Prior to meeting this girl, our friend was a serial monogamous branch swinger. The LTR girl he'd been with prior to her ran the show in much the same way for almost 5 years. When he was finally freeing himself from her, with a bit of my own help, he started to see the value of being single and independent and began dating non-exclusively for about a 3-month period. After meeting his now wife, he gradually tried to find suitable ways to withdraw and become exclusive. Knowing what our reaction would be in so swift a time frame, he began searching for all kinds of rationales to effect this and settled on the myth of the lonely old man. His story was the classic one, where a guy shakes off his old ways of thinking about women and dating and almost unplugs from the matrix, but fails to kill his inner AFC and slides back into his old beta mentality once he'd secured another soulmate. Here was a guy who'd spent more than half of his 20s in a miserable LTR, who managed to briefly unplug for about 3 months before latching onto another one-itis. Yet his reasoning was, I'm tired of the dating games. I need to settle down. I don't want to be lonely when I'm 60. This from a guy who'd only ever been single for 3 months of his life. It was his buffer. Of course, now he's resentful and pensive about his marriage and lives life vicariously through his single friends, while at the same time self-righteously scolds them for still being single. The myth of the lonely old man is a buffer against rejection. It's a hiding in relationships they're told they must constantly work to perfect, because of the fear of potential rejection. They're preset in this idea, while still single. They see it as a valid reason and a desirable goal. Get married quick, before it's too late. What's worse is that the rationale is unassailable. The foundation of the myth is associated with maturity. And who's going to tell you not to be more mature? This is how we get the kidult social convention women like to trot out. He'll never grow up. The problem is that this lack of maturity is only paired with a man's willingness to commit or not to commit to women's long-term provisioning goals. In the feminine imperative social construct, maturity means marriage, and marriage means provisioning. Don't buy into the powder puff idea that if you don't find your mythological soulmate, or the one by the time you're 30 and ASAP, you'll tempt fate and risk a life of quiet desperation. This contrivance only serves the interest of women whose imperative it is to enjoy their party years in their 20s with as many alphas as they can attract, only to later have a stable nice guy who's petrified he'll live a life of loneliness and desperation, waiting for them at 28 to 30 to marry and ensure their long-term security. Don't buy this lie. The man who is comfortable with himself and confident in his true independence is the one that women will want to be associated with and to share in it. How you handle being alone and what you do with the opportunities that freedom allows is the real measure of a man. If you are single and 50, you still have options if you're only brave enough to explore them. I know divorced men in their 50s who are dating mid-30s women right now, and I know men in their 60s who've been trapped and emotionally blackmailed by their wives for 30 years. Marriage is no insulation from the sexual marketplace. The myth of women and sex. Booty is so strong that there are dudes willing to blow themselves up for the highly unlikely possibility of booty in another dimension. There are no chicks willing to blow themselves up for a penis. Joe Rogan. One of the single most annoying tropes I read or hear from men, more so than even women it seems, is the women are just as or more sexual than men canard. Nothing stops me in my tracks more abruptly than reading this line parroted back in some form by a self-effacing white knight trying to convince himself, hope against hope, that it could be true. This is a very effective feminine social convention, even internalized and spouted back by the likes of more than a few infamous PUAs. This fantasy belongs among the higher order social convention myths, like the myth of sexual peak. Just a rudimentary knowledge of female biology is all that's needed to deconstruct the myth. Women are more sexual than men, but they are repressed due to society or a lack of trust with a guy. Patently false. A healthy male produces between 12 to 17 times the amount of testosterone a woman does. It is a biological impossibility for a woman to want sex as much as, or as often as, men. Trust that when a woman says, I don't understand why sex is so important to guys, she's speaking the literal truth. No woman will ever experience 17 times the amount of her own testosterone levels, barring steroids. Among its many other effects, testosterone is the primary hormone involved with stimulating human libido. I should also add that, on average, and barring environmental variables, a man's testosterone only declines 1% per year beyond age 40, so even at age 60, the average healthy male is only dealing with an average 20% deficit in testosterone. Critics of this observation like to argue that, for female sexual response and arousal, testosterone isn't the only factor to consider, to which I'll agree. However, it is the primary factor in sexual response. A woman cannot possibly understand what 12 to 17 times their present amount of testosterone could feel like without steroid use. In fact, the first effect female bodybuilders report when cycling anabolic steroids is a 100-fold increase in sexual interest and libido. So in terms of natural female hormonal biochemical response, there is no unaltered way a woman could ever make an accurate comparison to what a man's baseline libido is in relation to her own. Women's sexual desire is also cyclical, even at the peak of her ovulatory cycle, when she's at her horniest, she'll never experience what men do 24 hours a day. This is the root of the myth and the source of the social convention. Like men, women rely on testosterone to maintain libido, bone density, and muscle mass throughout their lives. In men, estrogen simply lower testosterone, decrease muscle mass, stunt growth in teenagers, introduces gynecomastia, increases feminine characteristics, and decreases susceptibility to prostate cancer. Sexual desire is dependent upon androgen levels rather than estrogen levels. I also understand that female sexuality functions differently than male sexuality, but this only reinforces my point. Women's sexuality is cyclic, not only on a monthly schedule, but also over periods of a lifetime, menopause and peak fertility, for instance. There are periods over a month and a lifetime where sexual desire waxes and wanes. Healthy men stays relatively constant from puberty to about age 40. Women are slower to arouse. They tend to need more than just visual stimulation. And there is definitely a psychological element. They need a fantasy necessary. Men only need visual stimulation and minimal feedback to get aroused, i.e. porn. It should come as no shock that postmenopausal hormone therapies use testosterone to boost women's flagging libidos too. When women are at the peaks of their ovulatory cycles, lo and behold, they experience a sharp spike in testosterone levels in order to facilitate pregnancy, and then it gets flushed out during menstruation. You can debate about how best to get a woman's testosterone flowing, but it's testosterone that's needed to prompt a sexual response. Now the real question is, why would such a popular myth be such a useful social convention? Think about it. It sexualizes women while not making them outright sluts. They can avoid the stigma of promiscuity while presenting the fantasy that they are secretly more sexual than they are allowed to be, if only they could meet a man skilled enough to bring this out in them.
It's a sexual selection convention.
The fantasy is that women are really these wolves in sheep's clothing for the right guy. To an extent, this is true. Studies do indicate that women in their peak fertility window do, in fact, aggressively seek out alpha males for conventional sexual encounters, especially so during the proliferative phase of their menstrual cycles. However, again, the root of this social convention is in the presumption that women are just as sexual as men, which is simply not the case, considering the conditionality that the female sexual response is dependent on. No self-interested man is ever going to be encouraged to refute the idea that women are equally preoccupied with, equally aroused as, or equally desirous of sex as men are. We love the fantasy that women are secretly yearning for sex with us. If only society were more open and accepting of feminine sexuality. Yet, in the same breath, we'll hear about how slutty and aggressive women have become in the fall of Western society by the same guys. It's ironic, but it gives guys hope that if they can find the secret formula to unleashing the sexual beast within every woman, you'll find this insatiable she-devil to pair off with monogamously. If women were men's sexual equals, why would they not be prone to the same drives that conflict with monogamy? Imagine a world where women are as horny as men. Think of a gay bathhouse and you might have a workable model. Women, of course, love to encourage and reinforce this social convention because it sounds like empowerment in the face of patriarchal sexual oppression. Yes, we'd be more sexual if you'd only allow us to, you evil men. While at the same time, tacitly acknowledging that turns men into white knight sympathizers of the cause, i.e. feminine entitlement and primacy. The point of my starting this topic wasn't to debate whether or not women are sexual at all. Obviously they are. However, it was my intent to draw attention to the canard that women, and their would-be male identifiers, would like everyone to believe women are just as or more sexual than men. No woman can make a realistic assessment about that unless she's had 12 to 17 times her natural testosterone levels increased and lived in a man's biological condition. Just on the face of it, the assertion is silly. But as I said, for women, it's empowering to think that women are just as sexual as men. And female identifiers are all too happy to reinforce that meme because it offers them the hope of getting laid with one of these sexually repressed women. The myth of the good girl. Good girls are just bad girls who never got caught. Allow me to relate here a case study I counseled a friend on personally about 6 years ago. I have a very good friend, Rick, that I hired and work with. Though we started out as work associates, he became one of my better friends and had the benefit of my personally having unplugged him from the matrix. He was a good student, for lack of a better term, but in becoming so, he went through a transformation process. Like most guys fed on a lifetime of feminine conditioning, he patronizingly accepted what I was initially teaching him, but privately, he still clung to his AFC mentalities. That is, until the turning point came. Unbeknownst to me, Rick had entertained a flirtatious friendship with a semi-attractive PR girl we were working with for a while. He knew what I'd said about LJBF rejections and playing friends with women, so he left me out of the loop on the whole affair. He had dated her on several occasions, but beyond the infrequent kiss while drunk, she kept him at arm's distance using the standard filibuster techniques women classically use. I'm not ready for a relationship. I'm not looking for a boyfriend. We're good friends, etc. She did, however, keep him in her attention web with little carrots of affection for him to pull her cart for about 3 or 4 months. Mind you, Rick was never a chump. He'd hooked up with his share of women. But this cute, good girl, who was at best an HB7, developed into a one-itis for him. This all came to a head when one night she had to do some work with Aaron Lewis. Yes, from Stained. While he was doing his solo acoustic act at our casino. To make a long story short, the PR girl ended up buzzed on this night and fucked Aaron Lewis' tour manager in a classic situation of right alpha, right environment, right conditions. Her mistake was in feeling the need to confess her actions to Rick, who'd felt betrayed considering all the investment he'd put into doing what he thought was the right way to go about things. Here was one guy on one night who she fucked in a moment of chemical reaction because he was hot, I was drunk, and one thing led to another versus his 3 to 4 month personal investment, i.e. relational equity fallacy. This was, of course, when he consulted me and informed me of everything leading up to it. Only now he was at an impasse. She apologized profusely to him and held out, once again, the olive branch of an LJBF rejection. He asked me what he should say, and it was at this point he took the initiative to tell her, no, we can't just be friends. He did what I advised him to, and he walked away from a woman for the first time in his life. This is when all hell broke loose for her. She'd never been met with this response before, and all the cards went straight into Rick's hands. She would consistently bump into him at bars or events to have another talk. She did a complete 180 in her attitude with him, all in an effort to be his friend. Now I'm exceptionally proud of Rick because, unlike most guys finding the true power of a takeaway, he stuck with it rather than being contented with her chasing him and then giving in to the LJBF. He had actually learned a valuable tool that he still uses now, the power of the takeaway. In addition, he also came to understand the principle of understanding a woman, not by what she says, but by what she does. The medium is the message. He learned the importance of reading behavior. Of course, after about 6 or 8 months, she stopped pursuing him to be friends, and he has talked to her in the interim years, but the frame of their discourse has changed. She has respect for him that she never had when he was the pursuer, and never would have had if he'd surrendered to another LJBF. Good girls. This girl, at every opportunity, loved to display her properness and would always say she wanted a man with a good heart when asked what she looked for in a guy. She was very outgoing, as befits a PR person, but at all times she presented herself as someone conscious of how people perceived her and her reputation. Hers was a classic case of basing estimations upon behavior above words. Biology trumps conviction. Sexuality, for as much as we think we can, will not go unexpressed. Celibate priest, moralistic conservative statesman, and the pure as the driven snow, virtuous girl you've got one itis for, all want to get off, and they'll find a way to do so. According to Facebook, she now lives in Montana with a thoroughly beta husband who likely has no idea that she had the capacity for raw, feral hypergamy. One of the trappings of a woman a guy perceives as a good girl is that he'll have a tendency to pedestalize her by default. White knights are a given, but even hardened PUAs are prone to want to read more into the personality of a good girl. A cutish HB8 good girl is a recipe for one-itis because she seems to be above seduction. I just want a guy with a good heart sounds so fairy tale perfect and with just the right amount of naivete applied. She comes off as a girl who truly believes Disney wishes really do come true. To guys with game, she's a jewel in the rough amongst the bitch-shielded mean girls that populate the new hookup paradigm. To chumpish white knights, she's an archetype, the innocent damsel who needs to be saved from the world before it corrupts her soul and she turns into all the other women who won't date them. Both of them are equally shocked when she spontaneously fucks an alpha tour manager. If you haven't done so yet, I highly recommend adding The Art of Seduction by Robert Greene to your reading list. In this seminal work, he begins by profiling the archetypes of seducers, and amongst them, we find our good girl is really the natural. A childlike innocence that masks a seductive motive. You may be inclined to think of a good girl as a prude, but this is often an error. The good girl needs to be seductively cute enough to make her hypergamy work for her. Any marginal prudishness is reserved for putting a suitor into stasis long enough to evaluate better options, or in the case of our PR girl, the option to capitalize on an immediate alpha experience. The good girl's game is built around playing to quality woman mythos that men harbor. They want to believe she exists among a sea of vapid, self-absorbed sluts looking to cash in before they hit the wall. She's not the prudish Madonna, and she's not the whore of Babylon. She's the cute good girl somewhere in between. She's only an HB 7 or 8, not the demigoddess HB 9 plus, so she also emanates the tantalizing potential of attainability. All of this makes for a very idealized, very cemented form of one-itis until it's graphically dispelled for the guy suffering from it. Just like all men have some form of game, women have their own game. Since we live in a feminine-defined reality, women's game is not considered subterfuge. It's simply how women are, or the feminine mystique. What makes a good girl contrast with other girls is still founded within this feminine social normalization. The wise practitioner of game knows what works best for him, but he must also be aware of the game being used against him. One of the most important aspects of the principle of amused mastery is actually having the mastery to be amused. That may sound cryptic, but what it means is having the experience to know what to expect from feminine game, mastering it, and being able to riposte with an amused laugh. For example, the operative goal of girl game is to maximize hypergamy. This is a foundation of game. So in knowing this, you can craft an amused response to any seduction methodology women use on you. The good girl is still looking for an alpha and will stop the good girl car to get out and fuck him should the opportunity arise. When you deal with the good girl or any of her sister's methods, always see them beginning with the end in mind. The myth of the biological clock. Popular culture likes to teach women, and by association, unenlightened men, that there is an innate biological clock inside each woman that slowly ticks down to a magical period where her maternal instincts at long last predispose her to wanting a child. Perhaps, not so surprisingly, this coincides perfectly with the myth of women's sexual peak, as well as conveniently being the age demographic just post or just prior to when most women hit the wall. The concept of a biological clock sounds very convincing on the face of it. It's biological, and when it comes to feminine social conventions, nothing convinces women more than their bodies, their selves. In girl world, biological reasonings are always suspicious rationales for men's bad behavior, but when applicable to women, biology is Mother Nature, and you don't argue with that bitch. Unfortunately, and as fate would have it, the hard science of biology often tends to crash headlong into feminine social conventions.
Lo and behold, many women underestimate fertility clock's clang. In 2011, NPR aired an article of the same title. It would appear that the cold hard science of women's actual fertility window doesn't exactly coincide with the articles of faith that feminine primacy is teaching them.
A new survey finds a big disconnect when it comes to fertility. The age women think they can conceive a baby is far different from what their bodies are actually capable of. This poses an increasing problem, as more women wait longer than ever to have children. What's the chance a 30-year-old can get pregnant in one try? Many thought up to 80%, while in reality it's less than 30%. For a 40-year-old, many assumed up to a 40% success rate. It's actually less than 10%. And when you keep trying? The survey finds many think you can get pregnant more quickly than it actually happens. It also shows many women underestimate how successful fertility treatments are. Not only is the myth of the biological clock inaccurate in terms of when a woman should get pregnant, it's dangerously misleading in the odds of becoming pregnant. The first thing they say is, "Why didn't anybody tell me this?" says Barbara Kalura, who co-authored the survey and heads Resolve, the National Infertility Association. She laments that no federal agency pushes this issue, and neither women nor their OBGYNs tend to bring it up. Though Kalura admits that fading fertility is a hard message to deliver. "Let's be honest, women don't want to hear that they can't have it all," she says. "We can have a great job, we can have a master's degree, we don't need to worry about childbearing because that's something that will come, and when it doesn't happen, women are really angry. I won't argue that women actually possess maternal instincts. I will argue that their understanding of when they manifest has been deliberately distorted by a feminine-centric cultural influence. If women are angry about the revelation their inability or difficulty to conceive in their post-wall biological conditions presents, their anger is misdirected. Rather than come down from the heady pedestal of ego-invested female empowerment psychology, they'll blame men for not being suitable fathers or lacking a will to play by the rules of the feminine imperative by whiling away their time in porn or video game-induced comas. I just feel like it's something else they lump onto women that we have no control over," says filmmaker Monica Mingo, who's blogged about her decade-long effort to conceive. She says the real issue is society at large, which is pushing back the age people are expected to settle down and have kids. Mingo didn't even meet her husband until she was 32. "You tell us your fertile years rapidly decline in your mid-20s," she says. "Well, if I'm not dating anyone and I want to have a family, what's that information going to do for me?" Well, for one thing, it might force you to come to terms with the course you want to set for your future life with an informed choice, rather than blaming it on so-called kiddled men when you do realize you want kids. I guess that's asking too much when you are in your prime party years at film school. Sorry, Monica, time's up. And you did have control over it in your pre-wall years. All the haggard ghosts of feminism are cackling heartily around the cauldron of boiling good intentions in hell. What we're seeing here is a collision of hypergamy and feminine primacy smashing against the harsh reality of biology. The feminine imperative needs to create a new social convention to make this incongruent reality agree with its doctrine. It's been done before with the convenient reinvention of sexual fluidity. Blame men for not living up to the tenets of the having-it-all ideology and create a convenient new social convention that shames men in its retro resolution of the problem it caused for itself. If there were an actual biological clock, it was ticking its loudest when a woman was 22 to 24, not conveniently when she needs male provisioning the most, and when her sexual market value is in declination by her mid-30s. The myth of male looks. Your bulletproof game and charming personality won't make you look any better when your shirt comes off. Looks. Assets. Game. Have two. Three is best. But if you only have one, game is the most essential. I realize that I'm heading into dangerous territory with this, but I maintain that looks are an integral part of attraction. Sorry, that's a fact of life. But I've never stated that looks cancel game. In fact, I advocate that learning game is just as necessary as maintaining a good physique. The problem is with people who can only think in absolutes. It's always an either-or proposition. Game trumps physique, or physique trumps game, is horseshit. They're both important and play off each other. There are plenty of average-looking guys who pull tail thanks to game in spite of their looks. And there are also good-looking guys who pull tail without ever hearing what game is. But wouldn't you rather be the guy with both? The guy who can pull women without compensating for personal deficits. Consider that greater than 66% of people in Western society are overweight. 33% are morbidly obese. So it stands to reason that two-thirds of the guys seeking out the community in order to change their lives, outlook, and sexual prospects are going to be struggling with obesity from the outset. Now also consider the preferred belief among guys that looks, at least, matter less than personality, game, etc., in female attraction. This is not a coincidence. For these guys, it takes more effort to change their bodies than to change their minds. Looks aren't as important for women. The first thing most men who were previously out of shape will tell you is the marked increase in attention they receive from women after they got in shape. This is perhaps the simplest experiment that puts the lie to this assertion. There is a popular misconception men adopt in thinking that looks aren't as important for women and that they're more forgiving of a few extra pounds if a guy is witty, humorous, and or embodies some combination of the laundry list of nonsensical adjectives they place on their online dating profiles. This is the male version of the body acceptance social convention women have been promoting themselves for the past 50 years. Don't worry about getting in shape. Money, humor, and confidence will make any woman swoon for you. If this were the case, the Louis Andersons and Danny DeVitos of the world would be swimming in top-shelf ass. I have no doubt that very rich but out-of-shape men have a relatively easy time attracting women, but they can't make a woman genuinely desire to fuck him on a physical level. It's just the very commercial version of negotiating desire. While this may seem like a male-specific social convention, guess again. It's actually a very calculated feminine convention. In terms of feminine breeding strategies and women's schedules of mating, it is far more advantageous for a woman to engage in short-term breeding strategies with alpha men during the peak of her sexual viability when she knows there is social structure ready to accommodate her long-term breeding strategy, i.e. provisioning, with future men. In other words, encourage men to think that looks aren't as important to women so they'll be more acceptable future providers while breeding in the short term with men embodying their very specific physical ideal. This is precisely the reason why the kid-alt, man-up phenomenon is so vexing for women today. It threatens this long-term strategy.
Chapter 10
Continued
Part 2
Priorities. In accordance with women's sexual strategies, women place an importance upon looks according to their phase of life. The priorities and importance of characteristics that women will consider prerequisites for intimacy shift as her life's conditions dictate. 14 to 24 years old, looks are everything. Yes, some romanticism might help complete the fantasy, and game is definitely a factor, but the priority for arousal is primarily Darwinian. Women will gladly overlook character flaws or a lack of assets in favor of fucking the physical alpha while she approaches her own sexual apex. For a brilliant study of this, take the time to read Dr. Marty Hasselson's study, Why Muscularity is Sexy, linked on The Rational Male. 25 to 30 years old. Looks are still of primary importance, but other factors are beginning to compete in significance as she becomes increasingly more aware of hitting the impending wall. While she's still hot enough to command attention, her hypergamic priorities lean more towards the lifetime provisioning potential and parental investment potential a man represents. As she gets closer to 30, she knows she has to play her cards well if she is to cash out of the game while she's still able to compete with other women. Ambition, character, assets, humor, personality, etc. begin to be more important in the light of a potential lifetime commitment. 30 to 35 years old. Most single women in this demographic are in varying degrees of denial, aided by social conventions, but on some level of consciousness, they realize that they're past their expiration date, and securing a commitment is a progressively more difficult battle with every passing year. Looks lose precedent in favor of assets and status. Game and personality become more prominent, but the primary focus is catching up to the choices she made or should have made when she was about 28. Locking down a proven commodity, a man with a reasonable amount of success and status, is the goal now. Not a man with potential for that same success. While the physical is still important, she's more than willing to compromise the physical standards she held at 24 if the man brings a lot to the table. 35 to 45 years old. She's well past her expiration date, hit the wall, and is, graciously or not, accepting the fact that she's used goods. Any notion of a list of requisites or priorities are a fond memory now. She may play the cougar card in an ego protection effort. This may seem like she's back to her primary looks focus in playing the cougar, but again, on some level of consciousness, she understands that younger men are doing her the favor by fucking her and in no way expects more than a physical fling. The hope is still, by some miracle, to lock down an aging AFC divorcee in a bad spot, with at least some amount of appreciable assets. Status is nice. Looks would be icing on the cake if he still got them. But provisioning takes priority above even game or social intelligence. Making the change. Changing yourself takes an effort. The greatest obstacle in change is the first one. Recognizing and accepting that you need to change. This is where AFCs and beta males chomp at the bit because they've been told for the better part of a lifetime to just be themselves and everything will go according to fate's plan. Then, for whatever reason, they unplug from the matrix enough to realize they've been sold a bill of goods and that personal change is necessary for them. They need to change their lifestyle, change their attitudes, change their outlook, change their minds about themselves, and yes, change their physiques too. But change takes effort, and people are lazy. They want the quick fix, the magic pill that makes them happy, successful, and sexually irresistible. so they flock to guys selling them the best program that promises all that for a minimum of effort. Game demands practiced effort, but it requires far less physical effort than improving one's body. And it's especially